The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Dr. Scott Youngkin for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Health Issues. For the next half hour, I'll be reading articles principally from the Harvard Health Letter. This is the Harvard Health Letter of January 2025. And the first article is entitled, 9 Ways to Stay Out of the Emergency Room This Winter. Identifying seasonal hazards and taking action to avoid them will help to keep you safe. Fractures, frostbite, and influenza. They're among the health problems that seem to surge every winter, the result of icy temperatures, seasonal activities, or exposure to infectious microbes. If the mercury is falling where you live, you might be vulnerable to any number of winter hazards. So it's a good idea to consider strategies to stay out of harm's way and avoid a sudden trip to the emergency room. Number one is beware slippery terrain. Navigating slick sidewalks, driveways, or roads can cause you to fall and break a bone. Whenever we have a deep freeze, we see a large number of people with bone injuries, usually of wrists, ankles, or hips. Says Dr. Scott Goldberg, Medical Director of Emergency Preparedness at Harvard-affiliated Brigham and Women's Hospital. To avoid those falls, always salt sidewalks and driveways before an ice storm. Salt is incredibly helpful in making surfaces safe, especially for people who are mobility impaired or who use assistive walking devices, Dr. Goldberg says. Also, wear shoes with anti-slip treads, or wear rubber or spiked shoe covers that you pull on over the sole of your sneaker or boot. Second, dress warmly. Cold weather exposure can cause 3 conditions. One is hypothermia, when the body loses heat faster than it can produce it, which can trigger a heart attack, kidney or liver damage, or worse. Another is frostnip, freezing of the outer layers of the skin. Frostnip is reversible if you warm up. If you don't, you might get frostbite, frozen skin, nerves, and blood vessels, which later die. Most frostbite cases we see are in folks who've been enjoying winter weather activities like skiing or snowshoeing. But hypothermia can happen outdoors or even indoors if temperature drops too suddenly. To stay warm outdoors, wear a coat and layers of athletic clothing that wicks away moisture. Include a hat, scarf, gloves, and heavy socks. Keep an extra stash of outdoor gear that you can wear indoors, too, in case your heating system goes out. You might also want to use disposable warming pads that you hold in your hand or attach to your shirt. Number 3, fortify your home. Temperatures drop indoors if you have drafty windows and doors, and if the furnace goes out, temperatures can plummet, depending on how cold it is outside. This is why we hear each winter about people who suffered weather-related injury at home. Prepare now. If it's in the budget, order a furnace checkup to make sure the unit is working properly. And hunt for drafty windows and doors. Try some low-cost fixes like insulation tape, weather stripping, or shrink-fit window film. Or hang a quilt over the door to block outdoor air. Number 4. Review space heater safety. Space heaters help when your furnace isn't warming your home effectively, but space heaters can cause burns and fires. Make sure the heater is rated for indoor use. Read the instructions and learn how to use it properly. Keep it a safe distance from walls, curtains, bedding, and other flammable surfaces. Don't put it right up against a bed. If electricity goes out and you can't use an electric space heater, don't turn to heaters powered by propane or kerosene. They're dangerous for indoor use and require venting to prevent carbon monoxide buildup. A fireplace or wood-burning stove is better, but it also generates carbon monoxide, so keep the flue clear install carbon monoxide detectors in your home, and put out the fire overnight. Find out if your community opens shelters during winter power outages and ask if transportation is provided for people who can't get there on their own. Number 5, ward off respiratory illness. Respiratory infections like flu, COVID-19, and respiratory syncytial virus, or RSV, peak in the winter, typically because people stay indoors more and trade germs, and possibly because exposure to cold air makes the airways of the lungs more vulnerable. Not only can these viruses make you quite sick, they can also increase the risk of heart attack. What you can do. Wear a scarf over your mouth and nose outdoors, and wear a mask in public indoor spaces. Also, stay up to date on vaccines. They reduce your risk of infection and risk of heart attack due to illness. What if you get sick? If you have a history of coronary artery disease, be cautious and rest. If you have any hints of chest pain that go away, reach out to your primary care doctor or cardiologist. If chest pain persists, it's best to go to the ER, says Dr. Christopher Cannon, cardiologist and editor-in-chief of the Harvard Heart Letter. Number 6, limit alcohol use. Some individuals drink alcohol after being in cold weather. Alcohol makes you feel warmer by enhancing blood flow to the skin. But alcohol, particularly several glasses combined with a rich meal, can cause a potentially dangerous irregular heartbeat called atrial fibrillation. In winter, this is called holiday heart syndrome. If symptoms last for hours or are accompanied by shortness of breath and chest pain, go to the hospital. And decrease holiday heart syndrome by skipping alcohol or limiting it to one daily drink for women or two for men. Number 7, ease into exercise. Is an ambitious new exercise program on your New Year's resolution list? Check with your doctor before starting it, especially if you have heart disease. Exertion increases the heart's demand for oxygen, even more so in cold weather. That also can lead to a heart attack. The best approach, if you've had a stress test in recent years and it was okay, it should be safe to proceed. Just increase exercise duration and intensity slowly. That way, if you do develop chest pain or shortness of breath with exercise, you can stop and check in with your doctors. Number 8, shovel snow with caution. Just like an intense new exercise program, suddenly shoveling wet, heavy snow can stress the heart and cause a heart attack. Cold weather adds to the risk by narrowing your blood vessels, which boosts blood pressure and might encourage blood clots to form. If possible, ask for help removing snow. Turn to loved ones for assistance or hire a snow removal service. Some cities, religious organizations, and volunteer groups provide snow removal to older or disabled adults. If those aren't options, approach the activity like a strenuous workout. Warm your muscles, stay hydrated, go slowly, and stop if you're dizzy or out of breath. Finally, number 9, build your emergency kit. Don't get snowed in without medicine, food, or drinking water. Stock up now on non-perishable food and drinking water. 1 gallon per person per day. And don't forget medicine. If a storm's coming, have a few days worth of food and water and a 2-week supply of medicine. Your doctor should be able to write an emergency prescription and you can keep it as your backup supply. As part of your kit, include a list of important phone numbers, your family, friends, neighbors, doctors, and local emergency management office. If possible, offer your assistance to neighbors. Make the connection now. Checking in periodically could provide someone a lifeline to avoid dangerous health consequences. Now we're going to continue with the Harvard Health Letter. And this is going to be a section called Ask the Doctor with Dr. Anthony Komaroff, who's the editor-in-chief. And the question Dr. Komaroff is answering: the holidays made me think of my family, my faith, and those new breakthrough weight loss drugs. Do they actually improve your health? And Dr. Komaroff responds, boy, do they. The GLP-1 receptor agonist drugs you're referring to lower blood sugar in people with type 2 diabetes and powerfully reduce weight in people with obesity. The FDA-approved formulations for weight loss are semaglutide or Wegovy, liraglutide or Saxenda, and tirzepatide or Zepbound. They are given by injection. The drugs lower blood sugar and weight in multiple ways. They release insulin from the pancreas, which lowers sugar levels. They block the action of a hormone that raises your blood sugar. They slow the digestion of sugars from the food you eat, and they act on the brain to reduce appetite. The GLP-1 drugs also quiet inflammation, stimulate the production of antioxidants, help repair damaged DNA, and slow the aging of body cells. But do they actually protect you against disease? Among people who use the drugs for diabetes and obesity, evidence suggests the drugs reduce the risk of kidney disease progression, heart attack, death from heart disease, death from COVID-19, and death from all causes from 15 to 35%. They may also slow the brain inflammation that's been found in Alzheimer's disease, reduce the number of flare-ups of COPD, and even reduce addictive behavior. As with any medication, some people experience side effects. The most common are nausea, vomiting, and diarrhea. Currently, the drugs are very expensive and are not yet covered for weight loss by some insurance companies. We don't know the benefits or risk of using these drugs for the long term. We often argue in these pages for the value of supporting basic biologic research. Research done to understand how the body works rather than to achieve a specific health goal. The GLP-1 drugs are an example of why. Several decades ago, a Harvard Medical School scientist, Dr. Joel Habener, using newly available basic research tools, searched for the gene that makes a hormone called glucagon. He found the gene and also was surprised to find another similar gene that no one knew about, a gene that makes a hormone he called glucagon-like peptide, or GLP-1. His curiosity aroused, over the subsequent decades, he and other scientists identified many different effects the hormone has on the body and how the hormone could be turned into a drug. To underline my point, Dr. Habener wasn't trying to cure any disease. He simply was curious. Those of us whose tax dollars supported his curiosity are the beneficiaries. His search for one known gene led him to also discover a second unknown gene, and completely unexpectedly, to the intervention of medicines that dramatically reduce the risk of multiple major diseases. Now here's another article from the Harvard Health Letter of January 2025. And it's entitled, What Really Happens in Upper Eyelid Surgery? It's lovely to see the sun setting on the horizon or observe autumn leaves drifting downward, but watching your upper eyelids gradually fall lower each year, that's a bit unsettling. The sagging, drooping skin might affect the way you feel about your appearance. Worse, it might interfere with your vision, with eyelids hanging so low and feeling so heavy that it's hard to open your eyes. Fortunately, a routine surgery can help. The fix for falling upper eyelids is a type of surgery called upper blepharoplasty. It takes place in an outpatient surgery center with anesthesia, local anesthesia, twilight sedation, so you're very relaxed, or general anesthesia, so you're unconscious and unable to feel pain, depending on your needs. During the procedure, a surgeon, an ophthalmologist, an oculoplastic surgeon, or a plastic surgeon will use a scalpel or laser to make incisions along the upper eyelid's natural folds. The surgeon will remove excess skin from both the left and right upper eyelids, possibly remove underlying fat, then close the incision with stitches. The procedure takes about half an hour. If you receive twilight sedation or general anesthesia, you'll have to go to a recovery room for about half an hour before you can go home. Recovery from upper blepharoplasty takes 2 to 4 weeks. You may have moderate temporary bruising and swelling around your eyes, but pain will be minimal. Icing your eyelids and keeping your head elevated will help reduce swelling. It's not unlike icing a twisted ankle. Put ice in a small towel and apply it to your eyelids for 10 to 20 minutes per hour while you're awake for the first 2 days. At night, use extra pillows when you sleep, so gravity will help drain fluid causing inflammation, says Dr. Michael Yoon, an oculoplastic surgeon at Harvard-affiliated Massachusetts Eye and Ear. You'll also have to rub a topical antibiotic ointment on your stitches 3 times a day for a week to prevent infection. After just 1 week, you should notice improvement, some reduced swelling, and eyes that are more open than they were before surgery. After 2 weeks, most people are healed and the puffiness is gone. It takes longer for some people, however, so don't schedule major social events until 3 or 4 weeks after your procedure, Dr. Yoon suggests. Don't expect a major change in your appearance. We can't give an older person their 30-year eyelids, but if your eyelids interfere with your vision, we can correct that, and we can provide a rejuvenating effect that helps accentuate what you like about your eyes, their color, appearance, and alertness when engaging in face-to-face interactions, Dr. Yoon says. Almost anyone who's bothered by the function or appearance of falling upper eyelids is a candidate for upper blepharoplasty, but it might not be right for people with certain serious eye diseases or prominent or bulging eyes because of an overactive thyroid, and it might be risky for people with severe dry eye syndrome, which can become more pronounced after surgery. Removing the excess skin allows the eyelid to open at a higher level, but when eyes are more open, they're more exposed to air, so existing dryness will become worse, Dr. Yoon explains. Another risk is noticeable asymmetry. The risk might be 5 to 10% because the unique way people heal can occasionally lead to mildly uneven results. It's best to look for a surgeon who performs upper blepharoplasty frequently, like every week. Is it worth it? If falling upper eyelids are interfering with your vision, insurance will likely cover all or part of the cost for upper blepharoplasty. The surgery won't be covered if it's for cosmetic reasons. Costs start at several thousand dollars, depending on your surgeon and where you live. Is it worth the investment? It's a good bang for your buck procedure, Dr. Yoon says. There's not a lot of pain and recovery. The results last 10 to 15 years, and you will literally be able to look in the mirror and see improvement. Now, here's a very interesting article. Are some cases of Alzheimer's disease caused by infection? What causes Alzheimer's disease? I spent most of my professional life trying to answer that question, says neuroscientist Rudolf Tanzi, director of the McCants Center for Brain Health at Harvard-affiliated Massachusetts General Hospital. It's an important question to answer because Alzheimer's is the most common form of dementia in many countries. In the United States, at least 10% of people over age 65 have the disease. As with most diseases, Alzheimer's is probably due to a combination of inherited vulnerability, the presence of other conditions, and social and lifestyle factors. And now scientists are investigating what part, if any, infection might play in Alzheimer's development. Alzheimer's disease was first described in 1906, but scientists began unraveling the mystery of its cause just 40 years ago. Today, researchers widely accept that two molecules are found at high levels in the brains of people with Alzheimer's: amyloid beta, which forms plaques in the brain, and tau, which forms tangles. Both contribute to the death of brain cells involved in thinking, leading to dementia. Amyloid beta probably is the most important molecule. It shows up earlier than tau, and Tansey and others have shown that people who inherit a gene that leads them to have high levels of amyloid beta develop Alzheimer's at a relatively young age. People who inherit two copies of the APOE4 gene variant are at even greater risk of developing Alzheimer's because they're less able to clear amyloid beta out of the brain. Inflammation in the brain is increasingly accepted as an important factor in Alzheimer's. In neuroinflammation, the brain's own immune system fights invading microbes or works to heal injury. Unfortunately, that also can cause injury, leading to more neuroinflammation, a vicious cycle that ultimately causes most of the death of neurons. Both amyloid beta plaques and tau tangles can trigger neuroinflammation, and so can many microbes, bacteria, and viruses. Some microbes can infect the brain and remain there without being completely eradicated by the brain's immune system, leading to chronic low-grade neuroinflammation. Even infections or other causes of inflammation outside of the brain, anywhere in the body, can send signals to the brain that trigger neuroinflammation. Some scientists believe infection might do more than cause neuroinflammation. Infection might also play a role in igniting amyloid beta deposits and tau tangles. My colleague, the late Rob Moore, and I found that amyloid beta is deposited in the brain in response to infection. It is a protein that defends against infection. It forms a web that entraps invading microbes. In other words, amyloid beta helps to protect our brain from infection. The bad news is that amyloid beta also damages neurons, which over 10 to 30 years starts to have obvious effects on cognition, ultimately leading to dementia. The chronic low-grade deposition of amyloid beta leads to tau tangles that also kill neurons and further increase neuroinflammation, which leads to more neuron death. Vicious cycles can develop and be very hard to stop. Which microbes might encourage Alzheimer's development? I think it's very unlikely that just one type of microbe, an Alzheimer's germ, is responsible, says Dr. Anthony Komaroff, editor-in-chief of the Harvard Health Letter and professor at Harvard Medical School. Instead, growing evidence suggests that a number of different microbes all can trigger Alzheimer's in some people. The evidence comes from studies of the brains of rodents and other animals that have been infected with microbes, as well as by finding microbes in the human brain regions most affected by Alzheimer's. Evidence also comes from huge studies showing that the risk of developing Alzheimer's is much higher in people who decades before experienced a severe infection. And recent studies suggest that Alzheimer's risk might increase because of shrinkage of the brain and a persistence of several inflammation-related proteins in the blood of people with past infections. Here are some of the microbes that are identified as potential culprits, and the first one is viruses. Some studies have found that DNA from herpes simplex virus more often in the brains of individuals with Alzheimer's than in healthy people. The viral DNA is especially prominent adjacent to amyloid beta plaques. Published results have come to contradictory results. Tanzi's laboratory is growing mini brains, groups of human brain cells. When these mini brains are infected by herpes simplex virus, they start producing amyloid beta. Another herpes virus that can infect the brain is the varicella zoster virus, which causes chickenpox and shingles. And this may also increase the risk of dementia. A study found that people who had shingles were more likely to later report problems remembering things. Ongoing research is exploring a connection between shingles vaccine and lower Alzheimer's risk. And the virus that causes COVID may also make the brain vulnerable to Alzheimer's. Other things that are associated with Alzheimer's include gum bacteria. Several bacteria that commonly live in our mouths and are causes of gum disease may increase the risk of Alzheimer's. Also, gut bacteria. In the past 25 years, scientists have discovered that the bacteria living in our intestines make substances that affect our health. It's one of the most important biomedical discoveries of our lifetime, Dr. Komaroff says. There is some early evidence that these bacteria could affect a person's risk of later developing Alzheimer's. How to change the composition of the gut bacteria to reduce the risk remains to be determined. Lifestyle factors like smoking, excess alcohol use, physical inactivity, insufficient deep sleep, exposure to air pollution, and a diet rich in sugar, salt, and highly processed foods are also associated with an increased risk of Alzheimer's. Well, it looks like we've run out of time for today's episode of Health Issues. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you enjoyed it. I'm Dr. Scott Youngkin, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Health Issues is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thanks for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service. Thank you.